A very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Robert Bound. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be continuing our coverage of Soft Power with Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, who spoke to some of today's leading experts on what this elusive concept actually means.
Soft Power always makes me laugh. It sounds like people having a pillow fight, doesn't it? What they're really talking about is cheaper ways of winning wars.
And finding a covert location for covert operations. We hear from a former spy to get her take on the most recent blunder plaguing the CIA. And finally, Barbie backlash hits China. Why America's favourite doll failed to win over fans in China will introduce you to the homegrown alternative that's become a dominating force. All that right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the news headlines from Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Thousands of people gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square today to bury one of the protesters shot dead by riot police. In the last few days, frustration with the military council has turned into outright anger, fueled partly by footage of the security forces' violent crackdown on the protesters. Some demonstrators said they'd come to Tahrir Square after seeing a clip posted on YouTube that appeared to show a member of the security forces dragging a corpse onto a pile of rubbish. The death toll from 4 days of violence in Cairo and elsewhere now stands at 36, prompting this ministerial statement.
The Prime Ministry Council has been following the events in Egypt over the past 2 days, which have caused the deaths and injuries of citizens. And because the government has a political responsibility, it has submitted its resignation.
The White House has called for an end to the deplorable violence in Egypt and said elections there must go forward. Saeed Haddadi, Egyptian researcher for Amnesty International in London, wouldn't say whether he thought elections would now go ahead.
Well, that's a question for the Egyptians to answer. But if they for us and ours as an organization, what's key for the elections to have elections, then we have to have a climate that would allow people to vote free from harassment and intimidation.
Saif al-Islam Gaddafi was betrayed by his captors by a Libyan nomad who said he was hired to help Muammar Gaddafi's son escape to neighbouring Niger on the promise he would be paid €1 million. The International Criminal Court prosecutor has said that Saif al-Islam does not necessarily have to be tried in The Hague if Libya's own justice system proves itself capable. Luis Moreno Ocampo told reporters on his arrival in Libya that he was not planning to meet Gaddafi's son. European Union governments have agreed in principle to extend sanctions against Iran by adding some 200 names to a target list of people and entities. The decision will be formally approved at a meeting of EU foreign ministers on December the 1st. Companies and organisations included will face EU asset freezes, and officials will be banned from travelling to the EU. Italy's new Prime Minister Mario Monti said today he's committed to turning around the country, but he offered no new details on how he will deliver broad reforms to invigorate the Eurozone's third largest economy. Speaking following his first meetings in Brussels since taking office, Monti said he was determined to win back investor confidence after Italy's short-term borrowing costs surged to levels seen as unsustainable, striking the 17-nation Eurozone to its core. Thousands of South Koreans have clashed with riot police during a nighttime protest rally against the parliament ratification of a free trade deal with the United States. About 10,000 workers, students, civic group members, as well as opposition party members gathered in central Seoul demanding the ratification should be nullified. The number two leader of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia has denied charges of genocide in a UN-backed war crimes court. Nguyen Chia, the party's ideologue, said that the Khmer Rouge revolution in the 1970s was aimed at freeing Cambodia from colonialism and protecting it from invasion by Vietnam. Anne Heindel, legal advisor for the Documentation Centre of Cambodia, noted that the defendant had avoided the accusations of genocide.
Even if you're defending against some sort of Vietnamese aggression, I mean, there's no recognition of any of the atrocities, any of the crimes that came out of that, as had been mentioned by the prosecution over the past 1.5 days.
Finally, Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych has allowed jailed opponent Yulia Tymoshenko to get medical treatment outside prison, relaxing a hardline stance after Lithuania's leader told him Europe had been shocked by her trial. She was jailed 7 years last month after being for 7 years last month after being found guilty of abuse of office while prime minister in a trial she and European leaders say was politically motivated. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Oh, thank you, Nick.
You're welcome.
Well, am I?
Well, you are. Most welcome.
We were talking about the protégé thing. We need you to have a. We need a newsreader protégé.
A newsreader protégé?
Yeah.
Well, where can I find one?
I don't know. I'd go and scout around upstairs.
Shall I? I haven't got time. I've got to get ready for the next one.
Pick someone up underneath your arm as if you were a farmer going to market with a pig. And that is how you.
That's how you do.
That's how you get a protégé. It's true.
I'll bear it in mind.
Well, I can't ask Thomas Schaffernacker. He's not in the building, but nonetheless, here are his global news headlines.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Europe first. Iberia and a large portion of the Mediterranean shrouded with rain-bearing cloud during Tuesday. Tomorrow, the rain will reach the Adriatic. Meanwhile, much of Central and Western Europe will have dry weather, just a little rain in London. Wednesday's city forecast. London 10 degrees, partly cloudy. Frankfurt 4 Celsius cloudy. Berlin, 5 degrees, partly cloudy here, and in Moscow, minus 4 degrees with some clouds. So air travel and the jet stream is pretty strong over the Atlantic in the coming days, a favourable tailwind for travellers from JFK to Heathrow. You might arrive a little quicker in Europe. North America, looks like there'll be a lot of rain in the lead up to Thanksgiving across the eastern half of the United States. Thursday itself, Thanksgiving, is looking a little sunnier. Here's Wednesday's city forecast. New York City, 11 Celsius and rain. Washington, 13 degrees with rain. LA, it's a sunny 18 Celsius. And in San Francisco, 12 degrees and partly cloudy. Air travel, delays are possible during Wednesday's heavy rain right across the eastern half of the United States. The Far East now, still a lot of sunny weather across eastern China, looking fine across the south of the country too. Meanwhile, rain heading to South Korea and Japan, and it looks like snow in Sapporo. Is Wednesday's outlook. Beijing, 4 degrees and sunny with frosty nights. In Hong Kong, it's 24, partly cloudy. Seoul, 7 degrees with showers. And in Tokyo, 16 degrees with rain. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas Schaffernacker, with the weather, clearly, not the news. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from Studio One. The time is approaching 8 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Sophie Grove, our senior editor on Soft Power. In a moment.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tämä on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. Now, today we're going back to our theme of soft power to celebrate our December-January issue, the theme of it, which is soft power. And I'm joined in the studio now with Sophie Grove, our senior editor.
Hi there.
Who's been up to her elbows in soft power. Been to a country manor in the wilds of Sussex to investigate the matter further.
Yeah, it's soft power boot camp, really.
Okay, is that what it's like?
No, it was rather nice. It was lovely. It was very intense 3 days with sort of soft power experts from all around the world debating essentially what it is and, you know, what their country has to offer, their strategy, their soft power strategy, and you know, some fascinating characters.
And in my head, I've got a sort of like League of Nations, sort of, you know, country manor house with lots of sort of liveried servants sort of passing the port to the right and all the rest of it.
Well,
is that what it's like? Is that what soft power's like? Is that what your job's like, Sophie?
At times, there was a little bit of that. But there was actually this incredible boardroom and you sat around overlooking these rolling hills and then, you know, people would just speak. And it was quite... you know, it was a really meeting of minds in the soft power world. They were really chewing over some of the concepts and sometimes sort of selling their country. And you could sort of see that some countries were sort of there to kind of, you know, just say how great they were.
Yeah.
Some people were kind of browbeating and trying to sort of talk about how...
That doesn't sound very soft to me.
No.
That's a hardball soft power.
I know. Then there was the head of NATO there at one point who was talking about the militarisation of soft power. Okay. Which seems a bit kind of mutually exclusive, but it isn't, they say.
It doesn't. It sounds like a tautology, doesn't it? I don't like the sound of that. Well, perhaps first, to set up our, to set up the discussion, Simon Anholt, who advises governments on improving and developing soft power strategies, is a bit of a nation branding expert. He told you, didn't he, exactly what soft power was.
For many countries, many of the countries represented here, when they talk about soft power, soft power always makes me laugh. It sounds like people having a pillow fight, doesn't it? What they're really talking about is cheaper ways of winning wars, right? Because, you know, it's cheaper to run an advertising campaign than to buy a tank. And so these countries are greedily eyeing the cheap competitive advantage that can be had from the soft power armory. So as far as they're concerned, it's just another kind of power and influence.
So he, Simon's quite he's quite honest about soft power then. He doesn't make it sound as if it's, although he says it's a pillow fight, which I guess is quite,
it's
quite a nice analogy, right? He's sort of a bit, he's quite real about it as well.
He is. He's really a sage on the subject. I mean, he had the ability to sort of summarise all this kind of existential angst that was going on. You know, when you talk about a concept for long enough with enough experts, so they're sort of kind of going around in circles, and he really sort of hits the nail on the head. What is this thing we're talking about? And he came, you know, as he just said there, it's really anything that isn't hard power. It's this kind of alternative to hard power. And it sounds, the concept itself can sound a bit woolly. but that's what people kind of came to. It sounds a bit broad, essentially, but I think Simon sort of knocks it on the head.
So do people, I mean, is he the sort of guru of this thing? Is he the, are people sitting at his feet while he dispenses bon mot and everyone's kind of like, you're so right, Simon?
I think so. He sort of was one of those people that sits back and then sort of comes in with the absolute sort of...
The killer phrase.
but he hates being called a nation branding expert, but he is something of a nation branding expert. And, you know, he consults around the world on these strategies. So he was a little bit damning about some people's, overselling themselves and in a kind of, you know, saying, aren't we fantastic? When actually, as he said, you can't tell someone you're funny. You can't tell someone that you're great. You have to be great. And that's exactly what... You know, he says the essence of soft power is a kind of very, you can't really trick people into kind of thinking your soft power strategy is great, because it's kind of an intrinsic thing.
It has
thing.
To be. It's like you've either got it or you haven't. People know you've got it or you haven't.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Like Groucho Marx wouldn't be a member of a club that would accept him. Sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's that weird sort of slight catch 22 idea. All right, well, we're going to go to India now. We're going to hear Navdeep Suri, who's head of Public Diplomacy Division, the Public Diplomacy Division of Ministry of External Affairs of India, had to say. Wow.
There's a business
card. There's a business card and a half.
Well, I believe that the idea of India is a very compelling one. It's a 5,000-year-old civilization, unique for its music, for its culture, for yoga, for Ayurveda, the ancient medicine. And then there are a number of contemporary soft power attributes. India is associated with IT. India is associated with Bollywood. Then you have role models and iconic figures like Gandhi. And I think all of that, plus the fact that amongst developing countries, this whole notion that we are the world's largest democracy are all very powerful attributes of the idea of India. And that's the key soft power story that we would like to tell to the rest of the world.
What a lovely voice Navdeep Suri has.
Indeed.
Doesn't he?
He does.
Tim Frazier's. India seems to be... India's got a lot of soft power attributes, hasn't it?
Yes. And
do you think it makes the most of them?
Well, it's interesting, India, because it's such an enormous place and it does have this kind of great... these great sort of associations of yoga and then IT and then all these modern wonderful things. But Navdeep was quite realistic. He kind of said, there's no way we can orchestrate this. We can disseminate it in our way. And they're looking at a lot of things online. They're sort of trying to sort of shepherd their soft power strategy rather than create one, which I think is very realistic for a country that's that big.
So is that is the idea of knowing you've got it or you haven't. And they know they've got it, but they know they can't force it down people's throats. Because it's the idea of being cool. We talked about this on the Monocle Weekly at the weekend, right? The idea of being cool is you shouldn't have to tell anyone you're cool. You shouldn't have to dress in a kind of cool way. You've either got it or you haven't.
Exactly. And India is doing fantastically with those ancient sort of cultures. Yoga is, you wouldn't immediately think, oh, there's a soft power asset. But actually, it is so penetrating. So many people, it's also so very benevolent. There's nothing sort of, apart from sort of people who take it a bit too seriously, yeah. as we all know. It's got so much of this kind of rooted, fantastic culture. So they're doing a very good job. Whether or not some of the more negative aspects of India, kind of they're sort of strategizing and sort of thinking about those. I don't know whether they're really just thinking about the positives and trying to just focus on them and sort of get them out on the web. That's essentially their strategy.
And chanting while they do it. We're going to go to Norway now. This is Mona Elizabeth Brota from Norway's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And Norway seems to be a country that... has a lot of, it's high up on our list of soft power nations. It's a sort of peacekeeper. It seems to be very civilized. It's a sort of great Nordic democracy and social sort of success story, isn't it?
Well, they've got the Nobel Prize and it's a really, an iconic soft power asset for them. And they're often talking about how they've got so much soft power. They're kind of doing this kind of covert soft power. So they're doing things
they've
like...
They've got so much yeah. that they haven't got it at all.
They're doing things they're not even telling people.
Invisible power.
Yes, and that's what they were really leading, pushing on, saying that don't brand everything, don't tell everyone about the things you're doing, because actually, implicitly, the soft power strategy works better when you don't trumpet it from the rooftops. And I think Mona talks about that a little bit here, and just some of the kind of quirks of the soft power strategy of Norway.
I would say that soft power is a key element in our foreign policy, and it's also a brand, you could say, that we take along in our foreign policy issues, in our contacts with the other partner governments, but also generally in both conflict and peace situations.
Quite a political... quite a cultured political response there from Mona Elizabeth Brota, who's Norway's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. What was she like? Are the delegates embodiments of soft power themselves?
They are, I have to say. She was very, she was just wonderful. You could just imagine her singing in a choir or something. And she talked about choirs, actually.
I've got an image in my mind now.
She was wonderful. She's kind of sainted type, and she incredibly. Incredibly wise on all of this. She had sort of 30 years experience in soft power. And she talked about a lot of things to do with the Norwegians taking their soft power kind of work and then using it in their own country. So learning from things that they've given other people in conflict resolution. So going to Russian borders and sort of setting up little, cultural groups with Russians and Norwegians to kind of try and settle these kind of wider disputes. So it was quite interesting to sort of hear how they were actually sort of gaining something. There is something in it for them. They're not just kind of going around doing good.
Okay, well, we're going to move swiftly on to a country that a lot of people probably don't associate with soft power, Israel, and we're going to hear from Mr. Ido Aharoni, who's Israel's consul general in New York.
Israel's soft power strategy is about celebrating what Israel stands for in a long-term strategic manner, with the one very central overarching principle, which is to talk about Israel in the context of what it stands for in the areas of creativity, innovation, dynamism, democracy, diversity, and so on.
And I suppose it is one of those things where Israel's in such a strange position in so many ways that it does force a lot of creativity. It does, it makes a lot of creativity, but not only in terms of the arts, but obviously in terms of making weapons and self-defense systems and all this kind of stuff. There's a lot of that going on, right? Which isn't very soft.
Yeah, it is that really difficult situation for Ido Aharoni. Was actually, he did speak at Wilton Park, the conference, and he sort of, a lot of the Arabs in the room were, very offended by him talking about, their strategy, for the arts and film. But actually, as he said, it's quite interesting, that Israel is, funding these all these films that sometimes are hugely critical of their foreign policy. And there are some quite interesting ideas that you can look at, you know, that soft power, it's got a kind of binary strategy. So they've got, you know, their boots on the ground and everyone knows, you know, about their controversial kind of policies out there. But then they've also got this kind of quite curious soft power strategy. So they're, you know, there's a film called Ajami, which they funded. It was set in Jaffa and, you know, Arabs in Israel. It's hugely controversial. And he was saying, you know, we funded this. So this is part of our strategy.
And there's lots of things that come out of Israel. I mean, we see, you know, on the culture desk here, we get a lot of films come out of Israel that sort of deal fairly sensitively with things that go on there. And, you know, we all know about Walks with Bashir. We all know about the sort of cultural success stories, Ron Aaron's, you know, design museum and all the rest of it. You know, there's kind of good stuff coming out of there. But a hard sell, I'd have said, at an international sort of soft power conference like that.
A very hard sell. I mean, it kind of brings the question, can you, if you are as loathed as Israel is, I mean, Is it even appropriate to talk about soft power? Mm. For some people it isn't, and some people they're very interested. And as you know, there's a kind of divided audience for the Israeli soft power market.
I should imagine. Well, Sophie Grove, thank you very much for enlightening us even further than we thought possible on soft power.
Thank you very much.
We better let you get in your on your plane to Iceland.
Yes.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Taxing the runway.
Indeed. Now, coming up next, we'll be speaking to Annie Macken about how to be a good spy, just after this.
So The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing. We are shining a spotlight on the people around the world who are driving innovation within their industry.
I didn't set out to become a perfumer, so it's almost an accident, which doesn't sound very business-like, but it is.
So it's not about bulls and bears, it's about small businesses, it's about the businesses you've always dreamed to set up. It's about the entrepreneurs who are daring to go out there and do it.
That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24 and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and of course on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, it's been an embarrassing few days for America's top spy agency. News emerged this week that the identities of a dozen CIA informants in Lebanon may have been revealed when they met with agents repeatedly and in the same place, namely the local Pizza Hut. It's been seen as a major failure for the CIA and one that could put the lives of these informants at risk. I'm joined now by former MI5 agent Annie Macken from Dusseldorf on the phone. Hi, Annie.
Hello. Hi. Well, thanks. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for giving us a call. Now, I wondered, what's your take on this story, really? This sounds silly, but could it have been quite a normal sort of modus operandi for spies?
Well, it's certainly a very sloppy modus operandi for spies, should we say it that way? No, the CIA has a terrible history of relying too much on technology, you know, sort of data mining, hoovering up telephone calls and emails and things like that. And they tend to be quite bad on recruiting human agents and running agent networks, which is what's going on here. And so in terms of their tradecraft, it's been immensely careless with these people's lives. I mean, any self-respecting geek or journalist or spy should know that there are certain base rules that you use if you're going to contact someone and try and meet them securely. And using mobile phones only very occasionally for certain calls, which sets up a track record, or meeting someone in the same place all the time, is very, very dangerous, because once you set up a sort of this is where all the spies go to meet, then it's very easy to blow the whole network. And I think they've been very careless with these people's lives.
So a meeting place is sort of rudimentary, is sort of day one of spy school. That's sort of the most rudimentary lesson, is when you meet someone, you meet them in a different place and you communicate, presumably not on a mode of communication that can be easily tracked, like the cell phones. I understand this was a cell phone problem, wasn't it?
Well, very much so. And it's also the sort of pattern of use of cell phones, so that they were using these phones, which were obviously just for communication between the handlers and the agents. And that was it. So it sets up a sort of unusual pattern of use rather than daily pattern of use, which you'd have with your normal mobile phone. But yes, I mean, meeting someone in a restaurant is bad anyway. Normally, if you want to meet an agent, you try and meet them in hotel rooms and you make sure it's a different hotel room every time, and you set up the meeting at your one meeting, you set up the next meeting so you don't have to talk about it electronically. So they've been incredibly careless, and I think it is part of the sort of the way the CIA tends to conduct itself, which is let's rely on tech rather than actual human sources. But these people are putting their lives on the line. I mean, you know, if you're infiltrating a terrorist organization in the Middle East and you get caught, it's not a case of even just going to prison for a couple of years. It's a case of probably being tortured and shot if you're lucky. Yeah. So they're very, very, very careless with these brave people's lives. If, you know, they should be seeing these agents as the sort of crown jewels of intelligence work.
So it sounds, from what you're saying, that the CIA have got a reputation for being a bit ham-fisted with this sort of operation then, and with the management of their sort of informants and double agents and that sort of more sort of far out their personnel.
Well, yes, but I think a lot of intelligence agencies can be a bit slipshod when it comes to dealing with human agents. Mm. I mean, we've seen this time and again in the UK as well, because, of course, the UK has had a long-running problem with terrorist groups from Northern Ireland, you know, until the peace process started 10 years ago. And again, we have a situation where many, many people who put their lives on the line to report on terrorist groups in Northern Ireland have been hung out to dry by the British intelligence services. So it's not just the CIA. I think a lot of agencies have a sort of laissez-faire attitude towards human agents. And it's a problem because they can provide the best information possible. I mean, you can put a bug on someone's phone or whatever, but you only get the information they speak about on the telephone. Whereas if you have a human agent run into a group, they can follow people around, they can interrogate them, they can talk to them, they can find specific information. So that they are very, very valuable in terms of intelligence information, but they're not valued in terms of dealing with them as human beings and running them and protecting them. And the spies can be quite sort of arrogant about this, I think.
And just finally, I mean, is this another idea of sort of where technology, like any office, like any job, you know, spying presumably is something that's become to rely on technology, like the rest of us in more mundane spheres of enterprise. Is this something that's hurt the CIA then, this idea of relying on, you know, on the tech rather than on the old-fashioned skills that you learn as a spy?
Well, the CIA has always done that. I mean, right from when it was set up in the 1950s, they've always preferred the tech stuff. But European spy agencies tended to rely more on human agents. But I have to say that even they could be quite sort of relaxed about the security of those agents. But no, I think, of course, you know, once the tech's there, then it's very, very tempting to use that tech because it's easier and it's less hassle than trying to run a human agent. But one other thing I find interesting about this story is that every time we have whistleblowers coming out of intelligence agencies, or we have stories around things like WikiLeaks, for example, everyone says, well, this is terrible, you know, whistleblowers and WikiLeaks are endangering agent lives. But time and time again, it seems that actually it's the intelligence agency's slipshod security practices that do actually cause more damage to agent lives than whistleblowers. So it's fun to watch, I think.
Well, I'm glad that it's not just us mere mortals, it's the spy world as well that is constantly tempted by the all-you-can-eat buffet. Annie Macken on the line from Dusseldorf, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. And after the news, we'll be talking about the toy wars happening in China. But first, a quick song. Here's Yellow Balloon by Twin Shadow. That was Twin Shadow's Yellow Balloon, taking us just past the bottom of the hour, where it's time for the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Rob. Egypt's ruling generals have offered to transfer power to a civilian president by July in a dramatic attempt to placate protesters and defuse a political crisis that has jolted plans for the country's first free election in decades. Turkey has called on the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down for the sake of his people and the Middle East, tightening regional pressure on Damascus after Arab states threatened sanctions over its crackdown on unrest. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor has conceded that the captured son of Muammar Gaddafi may be tried in Libya rather than in The Hague, meaning he faces the death penalty if convicted. Spain's short-term borrowing costs hit a 14-year high today as political uncertainty about a solution to the Eurozone's sovereign debt crisis punished another vulnerable southern European country. Pakistan's ambassador to the United States has resigned days after a Pakistani-American businessman said the envoy was behind a controversial memo that accused the Pakistani military of plotting a coup in May. South Africa's parliament passed a bill on protecting state secrets today, despite criticism at home and abroad, that it harks back to apartheid legislation and makes it easier for corrupt officials to conceal graft. The Khmer Rouge revolution in the 1970s was aimed at freeing Cambodia from colonialism and protecting it from invasion by Vietnam, the party's ideologue Nguyen Chia told a court today, opening his defence against a charge of genocide. And as Myanmar loosens media controls, one woman's image is everywhere, from newspapers to magazines to television programmes, pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, or simply the lady, as she is known in the country. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, the man, Nick Kelly. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bound, where we turn our attention to China, where environmentalists this week are celebrating a small but important victory. Luxury hotel chain Peninsula Group announced today they'll be banning shark fin soup from all their hotel menus. Shark fin soup, as you may know, is an important Chinese delicacy, a staple at important celebrations. But high demand has pushed many shark species to the verge of extinction. Our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, spoke earlier to the COO of the Peninsula Group, Peter Burra, in Hong Kong. He started by asking him the reasons behind the ban.
Over a number of years, we've sort of been monitoring the whole question of shark fin, and given the mounting scientific evidence on the drastic decline of the shark population, we believe that this is really the right time for us to take a more definite stance and in conserving this ever-decreasing asset to the world.
But I mean, shark fin is, you know, still widely consumed across Asia. It's a, you know, it's a big Chinese delicacy. Do you have a lot of customers that you think are going to be slightly unhappy about this?
No, actually, we started the program more than 2 years ago where we offered guests who wanted to eat shark fin a very good alternative, or we gave them even incentives not to eat shark fin and would upgrade the rest of their banquet menus. As you know, in Hong Kong, shark fin is traditionally served on wedding banquets. And so we gave the wedding couples incentives such as an upgrade to a better bridal suite or, you know, other delicacies on the menu.
You offered them a better room if they didn't have shark fins.
Yeah. You know, you have to make people interested in participating. And that was actually extremely well received. But then if you look at the scientific data, as I explained to you earlier, it is really, you know, alarming how the shark's population is decreasing. So now we have decided to take it to the next level, and we are confident that this is the right decision in line with our, you know, corporate sustainability program, which we want to be, you know, a credible participant in good causes, and we clearly this is one.
And so if I can't eat shark fin soup if I come to a Peninsula Hotel anymore, what would you recommend instead?
Oh, we would recommend abalone, we would recommend bird's nest, we would recommend any, you know, double-boiled soup with mushroom inside. I'm not a Chinese cook, but I can tell you there are other many wonderful things that we can offer you. When you come to Hong Kong, I'll take you to lunch.
Okay, right. Well, I'll have to take you up on that. Let's talk slightly more broadly about shark fins. Outside of what you're doing, you know, within the Peninsula Group, are other restaurants, other hoteliers starting to consider whether they use shark fins or not? And also, are consumers starting to buy it less?
Yes, absolutely. Especially, you know, the younger generation is clearly on our side, and we are delighted about that. We have the great privilege of being Asia's oldest hotel company, and hence we find it is almost our responsibility to take the lead in this. And we hope that many others will follow.
Excellent. Well, Peter Borer, CEO of Peninsula Group, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And that was our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, talking to the Peninsula Group CIO about the timely demise of shark fin soup. Sorry, it's a tongue twister as well. In a moment, we'll be staying in China to talk about Toy Wars. Welcome back. Well, now we stay in China, where an American toy giant is in trouble. Barbie made a big splash in China in 2009 when it opened a six-story flagship store in Shanghai. But America's favourite doll failed to make any inroads. The store shut in May of this year. I'm now joined by Monocle's Shanghai correspondent, Justin Bergman, who joins me on the line from New York. Justin, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining me. Thanks for helping me out of a slightly tongue-twistery introduction there. Now, you're our Shanghai correspondent, but you're in New York at the moment. Are you escaping a sea of flailing, angry, Barbie-wielding Chinese children?
Yeah, something like that.
So what went down? I mean, Barbie seems to us a solid toy brand. We can't imagining it sort of being exported and falling on stony ground. Were you surprised to see this as much as anybody else?
Yeah. Well, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. Mattel, which makes Barbie, sort of made a few mistakes here in going into China, and the preconception is that every company that goes to China is going to do well just because it's China. But, you have mistakes if you don't plan well. And because Barbie's not a known quantity yet in China, they did kind of screw up on a few fronts.
And, it's not to do with a funny little blonde doll. It's not something as simple as that sort of thing. Is there a more intrinsic reason, a deeper down reason why it wasn't a hit in China?
Yeah. Well, what they did is they just shot too high. I mean, they opened this huge flagship store, which is six stories, which has never been done before anywhere. And this was the first one in the world, and they just assumed that people would flock to it. But what they did is they had too many competing interests involved. They were offering an adult clothing line designed by the designer from Sex and the City. And what they didn't realize is that, this was aimed at adult women, 20, 30-year-old women. And they didn't realize that the Chinese women of that age don't really like to dress in that way. I read
like
that
doll.
The clothes were that the clothes were a little too skimpy and not playful or Hello Kitty-ish enough, I guess you could say. So they also had a cocktail bar, they had a restaurant, and it was just too much. They weren't really focusing on the brand itself, which was Barbie, and trying to get kids into the store.
Yeah, it sounds definitively creepy to have a sort of clothing line for the kind of women that would be buying these things for their children. Full as in full size adult clothing. I wonder if this is sort of a common theme, whether people hit China too hard, whether a toy manufacturer or a game manufacturer, whatever they might be, always expecting China to lap everything up that the West hits it with, right?
Oh, absolutely. And they had the wrong business model for China. And what they've done differently in India has actually worked better. And they're starting smaller. They have opened smaller stores within malls, which is what they should have done in China as well, because the Chinese consumer, they like going to malls. Standalone stores don't really work there. And they've been advertising in India directly to children on children's networks, trying to spread the Barbie brand that way. And in China, they just assume that if they hit the market with this big splash, that it will get enough attention and that they would be successful, but it obviously didn't work.
And was this covered much in Chinese newspapers and Chinese media? I mean, was it reported that Barbie was coming to Shanghai, and then suddenly it wasn't there? I mean, was this covered? I mean, or was this just kind of, did they slip in and just sort of creep quietly off back to the U.S.?
Well, I think, yes, when they opened, it was a big deal. Obviously, any big Western thing coming to China gets a lot of attention at first. But when they failed, I think, they kind of went out on a whimper. People just didn't really respond to it, and so they didn't pay much attention when it left either.
Right. And let's not forget the sort of leader of the taker of the cute little miss crown, which is Princess Secret, which is China's own version of Barbie, right? Does this have an unassailable, does Princess Secret have an unassailable stranglehold on the cute market?
Yeah, well, it looks like it may. Princess Secret looks disturbingly like Barbie. It's kind of funny. It's like the Barbie knockoff, which China's really good at. So what Barbie's stumble has done is left a kind of a gap for the local producers to manufacture their own dolls. And what these exporters had been doing before is exporting dolls for Europe and North America. But as the markets have slowed in those places, they've turned their attentions on China. And Princess Secret seems to be doing pretty well, from what I've read.
I'm presuming you've inspected the beauty and build quality and playability of both Barbie and Princess Secret, Justin. I know that is casting no aspersions on you whatsoever, of course. Are the two things comparable as products? I mean, is Princess Secret perhaps a little shoddy around the edges, or does Barbie pale into insignificance against the beauty of the Chinese doll?
Well, they look almost exactly alike, and that's what I find kind of interesting, is that this blonde-haired, blue-eyed doll is what Chinese children are attracted to. So they're not, you know, Mattel did have a Chinese Barbie named Ling, which didn't do nearly as well as the regular Barbie. But as far as Princess Secret, you know, I haven't really tested it out quite thoroughly enough, so I can't tell whether it's a shoddier version or not. My assumption is it might be.
And I just wonder, just before you go, whether Princess Secret presumably has lots of adverts on Chinese TV, right? I mean, and is advertised around the place. Are dolls in China marketed to children and children and adults in the same way as they are in the West? Is it a cutesy thing? Is it tea parties? And is there a Ken to Princess Secret's Barbie?
I don't know if there's a Ken yet. that I'll have to check on.
That's a secret.
Yeah. She's hiding that right now. But, yeah, it has been marketed in somewhat the same way. I mean, when you see kids go to the old Barbie store, you know, it looked exactly like what you'd expect a Barbie store to look like in the West. I mean, it was all pink and purple, and it was decked out from, you know, from top to bottom in Barbie, you know, items, accessories, clothing, and dollhouses and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, it really is quite stunningly similar to what you see in the West as far as marketing.
All right. Well, Justin Bergman, on the line from New York, but our Monocle Shanghai correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us from the safety of the Big Apple, away from all those unhappy children in Shanghai. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk more about Barbie in China with comedian Anna Chen. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House in Studio One with me, Robert Bound. Continuing our chat about Barbie in China, I'm joined in the studio now by British Chinese comedian Anna Chen, who watches a lot of cultural happenings in China.
Hello, Rob.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for asking me.
Watches a lot of the cultural happenings in China through the prism of comedy. That's what we're hoping. So, that's what we were sold. Come on.
Okay. Oh, sorry. I thought I was going to be an economist today. But no, I think it's quite good. I mean, I already despised Barbie dolls when I was a kid anyway. I was more of a chess set and chemistry kit girl.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Come on. Are you pretending? Yeah, I was reading Dostoevsky in the original Russian. I didn't have much time for toys.
Yes, I was only 2 years old at the time.
Okay.
You next.
And I was having spoken to Justin on the line about this, about toy wars, I'm quite surprised that Chinese girls like to play with little blonde dollies.
Well, that is actually quite scary. I thought by now, actually, that they would have gotten into images of themselves.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, here, you see, I can understand Chinese kids in the West feeling that way because there are no representations of them anywhere in the media, you know, unless you think of sort of Fu Manchu. But given that only 35 cents out of every 20 buck doll actually goes to China, I think this is quite a good thing that they are kicking out the imperialists.
Right.
You know. And so I'm quite pleased that there is a doll that's taking its place. Where I'm not pleased is the fact that, A, it's a princess, and, you know, I'm thinking, oh, wow, didn't all those years of communism teach you anything? No. So it's actually worse, Rob. It's worse than just the race thing. It's the whole class thing again.
So they've thrown out Barbie, who is a meritocratic icon of slightly big, what we could call big-titted blondness, right, for a doll.
Mm, very realistic. I know lots of women who look like that.
All right. But what they've got in their place is they've got themselves an unmeritocratic monarchy. That's what you're complaining about. You have read deep into the tea leaves of Chinese culture.
I have indeed. I've looked at the yin and yang of this, and it's all a bit of a squiggly grey mess at the moment. But I just can't understand why they would go for blonde figures, really, because if you think that they're supermodels, there are some incredible Chinese supermodels coming up who are just jaw-droppingly gorgeous. And of course, the north of China has always produced these sort of 6 foot Amazons that we didn't get to know because mostly it's Cantonese here, and I'm afraid we Cantonese do tend to be on the short side. I'm 5 foot eight myself, but
this isn't a Lonely Hearts radio show.
It is. Anyone who wants someone with long black hair.
You'll be fine. So anyway, what I wanted to know is how do you think Barbie was this thing of this huge sort of six-story tower block, this Babel of Barbie that was opened in Shanghai, which Justin was telling us about, is that he was certain that this was part of the reason why people in China didn't dig it, because they like shopping malls. They like something that's maybe not, although it's a shopping mall, they want something that's not quite such a hard sell. I mean, is there an anti-American thing in this, do you think?
I think it's interesting that what we're seeing as the economy is slipping and you know, basically, we in the West, we're not going to be able to afford these Barbie dolls for much longer. And it is interesting that they are going for the Chinese market because, of course, the toy market, the domestic toy market there is growing exponentially. And soon, you know, our children are going to be playing with sort of twigs in puddles.
Twigs in puddles, hoops and sticks.
Yes, if we're lucky.
Well, in that case, in that scenario, then Princess Secret, the Chinese doll, is then going to be exported to the rest of the world. Mm. What's the take-up on that? How will the Chinese brand it for the rest of the world, do you think? Will they use Chinese branding techniques? Will they use Western branding techniques? And what are those techniques, Anna?
Oh, the secret techniques.
The secret techniques.
I think it probably involves garlic and soy sauce.
Yeah.
And a bit of kung fu. I'd imagine some sort of kung fu Barbie would have been good. Haven't Mattel already bought out like a black doll? I thought they were.
Yeah, probably.
Throwing a sop to you know, race relations. But I think it's basically US cultural dominance now being firmly challenged. And although, okay, Princess Secret now is blonde, I can see a time when those superstar models and movie stars, you know, start to really supersede the others we've seen. And you know, the Barbie dolls aren't real anyway. I don't know what they're based on, some sort of 1950s ideal of a Chevrolet Packard driving family.
She's a bit Betty Draper, isn't she, Barbie?
Yes, but with an even weirder figure, I would say.
All right. Yeah, because I wonder whether this is the thing, whether history is repeating itself and coming full circle, and whether we will start to buy, you know, the idea of beauty changes. Is that something that maybe is mirrored in the toys that we play with, and the colour of the toys and the colour of the hair of the dolls?
I think your thesis would have been correct if these Princess Secret dolls had black hair and almond eyes and so on. But as they are blonde, I mean, I'm actually looking forward to Barbie and the Princess Secret in the Thunderdome sort of slugging it out in the markets. And I also look forward to a time when My Little Pony actually becomes the Grass Mud Horse, which I'm sure you know what the Grass Mud Horse is.
Well, no, I don't know what Grass Mud Horse is.
Oh, no, it's not 9 o'clock yet, is it? Do you have a...
I think you can tell us what it is. I think it's safe to tell us what it is.
You know that one of the ways that dissident thought in China is expressed is in this mockery of authorities through the various characters. So every time you come up with something like, I don't know, Tiananmen Square, the obvious ones, they get banned. And gradually you get this replacement with words that are a sideways on having a go at the authorities, like river crabs, which means harmony. So it's a sarky, it's a very sarky way of having a go, and grass mud horse, which means something very rude about your mother.
Right. I was going to leave a bit of radio silence there for people to cogitate on that. But I think I can understand it. Now, also, we want to know what you played with when you were a kid. I mean, was this? Did you grow up? You're Cantonese. Did you grow up in Hong Kong? Or did you grow up in Britain?
I grew up in the Far East of London, in Hackney.
Okay, right.
And I had.
So that was stick in a puddle territory, was it?
It was. I'm afraid it's sort of, you know, knives and shivs and Stanley blades, but I did also have some dolls, but I just found them boring.
Okay,
you know? I really didn't. I got into Superman comics quite early on.
Yeah.
But toy wise, I don't know. Sort of games. I was more of a games person, I suppose. The idea of just sitting there with a doll and projecting yourself onto this inanimate object, you know, doesn't work for me.
All right. Do things have to move then? Is this the thing? I mean, is this one of the reasons why, is this one of the reasons why dolls are dying out? I mean, do things have to move? Do things have to be exciting? We all know about these dolls that can kind of do, that can perform bodily functions, right? They were a hit, weren't they? That was kind of like
that's
late 70s, early 80s.
Far East. Oh, no. Oh, I see. You're not coming up to date.
Not with that.
Not with the Japanese ones.
It's still sort of a family show, depending upon what time zone you're
listening
to.
No, I was thinking of the ones that weed themselves and you had to
yeah, exactly.
You
know,
give
that's
them
what I mean.
Milk and,
yeah, yeah.
and stuff like that.
But is this the thing that dolls are simply boring because you have to use your imagination?
I think
because you have
I
to
mean,
pretend that she's getting married or she's going to the shops or she's cooking someone breakfast.
What is that? I mean, this utterly boring, you know, it's like you, the guy in China just now was saying, or where was he, Hong Kong? Yeah, oh, it's just awful. I really like Doom. I mean, when I discovered Doom, and I actually got to the end of Doom, and that takes some going.
Is this Doom, that's the computer game which you shot
Doom,
everyone?
The shoot 'em up
right.
video.
Right.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that I got into only a few years ago, actually, but...
Talking of machine gunning people, talking of machine gunning our audience, do you want to give us a quick plug for Anna May Wong Must Die? Anna May Wong is your alter ego, right?
No, Anna May Wong was Hollywood's first Chinese
screen legend. Of course
she
was.
She was the most famous Chinese woman in the 1920s and 30s.
Are you taller than her, though?
I'm an inch taller than her. She was 5'7". I mean, she was big. She was definitely tall.
Yeah.
I'm 5'8" with size 7 feet. So I am considered large
right.
for a Chinese woman. No, she was gorgeous, but the way that the West viewed her, you had the whole of the race war being played out, all that yellow peril stuff being played out with the way she was being regarded. So she wasn't just in a race war, she was actually the battleground. So I thought it was quite fun just to look through her experience of really being... She was either the Dragon Lady or the Lotus Blossom. She was the archetypal Dragon Lady and the archetypal Lotus Blossom, which is weird when you think it's one actress who could do both at the same time. And I think that shows how supremely talented she was.
It's
well.
What every
Beautiful.
Man wants. It says here, it's a journey through the life and crimes of Hollywood's biggest Chinese screen legend and deals with Western attitudes towards the Chinese. Might be sort of relevant. People can find out more about that at annachen.co.uk, right? That's where people can find tickets to the show.
Or Madam Meow or my Madam Meow blog.
All right.
Which causes a stir occasionally. I'm banned by The Guardian
Uh-oh.
And by the Chinese firewall.
So are we. Anna Chen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Here is a song to take us up to the top of the hour. It's Odessa by Caribou. That was Odessa by Caribou. And that's all from us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Constance Cheng and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Nick Kelly is here with the headlines in just a moment. Then at the top of the hour, it's time for Section D with Hugo MacDonald.